Okay, you had a reading assignment that was voluntary, so I'm not sure how much of an assignment it was, but it was a suggestion. Impressions, if you had an opportunity to read the Paschal homily of Melito or Melito of Sardis. Some of you have the look like, oh yeah, he said that, didn't he? I can just sit down and read it for you if you'd like. Okay, Arlene. No, he's a Christian. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, this guy was a Christian, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. There's no real application. It's just kind of proclamation kind of stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For me, there's a section, especially towards the end, where it has a feel of kind of black preaching. There's a cadence that kind of starts with it, and it's really interesting. But some of the images that he has, that he who essentially kind of like formed the tree is hung upon a tree, those kind of things that he gets into are just kind of interesting ways to go about it. But that, So I lift that up for you. We don't have to spend much time on it. If you didn't get a chance to do it, it's still up online. You can do that this week. Go ahead. Yeah.
And so for me, he likes things in order.
Well, it was order. I just took chunks out. So
I'm like,
when I started to get this ready for you, I was thinking of printing it for everybody. And it's, I think this might have been 6 pages. So it would have been, I think, about 10 to 12 pages. Yeah. 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 And those numbers are added by editors later, just so that when you're talking about where in the document, it's almost like adding verse numbers to the text. They're not original with the text. They're just like so that everyone could go back and look at it and be at the same place. So he wouldn't have sat down and said, okay, now 103. He's just doing his thing, and those numbers were added artificially later. It was actually a sermon to be preached at Passover, at the Christian Passover, so around the time of Holy Week. Yeah. And it's from this era that we have. There is, interestingly, no one mentioned it, maybe only two people read it, I don't know, but there is a little bit of anti-Semitism in it. There's kind of a strong accusation against the Jews, and that the church has kind of stumbled in its way throughout history of finding out how it relates to Judaism. We can see it even in the Apostolic Fathers. So in the Didache, there's less there than here, but you get a little whiff of that every once in a while. And it's one of those things that, like, I love this document except for that. If you didn't say that, it would have been better. But it is what it is. It's a historic document. So, anything else? We'll plow ahead to some other stuff. It was riveting, wasn't it? Glad you liked it. So, that's an interesting sound to do on a microphone, isn't it? We were talking about heresies, and that is an H. Which ones did we talk about last week? Docetism, thank you. Which means to seem. It's a heresy against the incarnation, that he only seemed to take on flesh, and another version of it was that he only seemed to die. So that was one early one. Another one, Marcionism, following Marcion, who basically would be the arch anti-Semite in the church, that he was son of a bishop, and he was saying, we don't need that Old Testament at all. It's a different God that we see than the God of Jesus. And he was very Pauline in his, he followed Paul religiously, vigorously. Paul was his hero. But the jettisoning of the, you know, 2/3 of our scripture is a problem for the most part. So we're going to look at a couple other ones today. Another one that was emerging at the same time is Gnosticism. And it's related, actually, to Docetism and Marcionism in some ways. So what do you know? You've probably heard that term before. What do you know about Gnosticism? Yeah. There was this information out there, and a select few people would either have spent enough time or gone through the right process of putting themselves in a place to receive this special enlightenment, or and other versions of it would be that they were just kind of the elect and they would be given the special enlightenment. But there were ins and there were outs, and only the ones on the ins had the special knowledge. Yeah. In that one instance, it's a little scary how much kind of typical evangelicalism gets a little bit close to Gnosticism. That all you got to know are these special things about Jesus. And the ones who know it and say yes to it, they're on the in, and everyone else is on the out. I consider myself an evangelical, let me be clear, but I think some parts of evangelicalism are scarily close to Gnosticism.
So what I've heard about Gnosticism, like the thing that strikes me the most is it's sort of just this weird secret society type thing. It seems like to be like very similar to kind of, at least when people talk about it, it's like kind of the way people talk about like Masons and Masonic rites. Are these related at all, or what? Mystic knowledge wrapped up in secrecy.
You touch on one of the kind of the struggles by Christian historians that is still going on today. Is what is this? So some would see Gnosticism as kind of a departure from Judaism. That Gnosticism's roots are actually in ancient Judaism. And it's a rejection of ancient Judaism. And in that way, it's going to be very much like Marcion. That's where I was saying that parallel is. That because they have this radical dualism, so that anything that is of matter, it's very kind of Platonic, anything that is of matter and has physical substance is inherently bad. The spiritual stuff is good. This is, again, where it gets close to evangelicalism. So in this way, it's kind of a rejection, a departure from Judaism. And some see, you know, why is it that everywhere we see Gnosticism, there is Judaism present? And that is a true statement. So some would see it as a departure of Judaism. And that, in that sense, it would predate Christianity. Others see it as actually its own religion. And at times, it's just, as it drives down the road, sometimes it gets close to the side of Christianity, sometimes it gets close to the side of Judaism, but it's really neither of those, it's its own thing. And then others would see it as, at least in its kind of incipient form, a departure of Christianity. That those who would see Gnosticism as a full-blown heresy see it as a, okay, these folks were Christians and are now doing and saying these things. And so part of the difficulty is we still don't know. There are clearly Christian Gnostics. So there are people who had some part of the Christian faith who departed and went kind of crazy into Gnosticism. So there is a Christian Gnosticism. So we do know that. But whether it's always this, or because there are, you're right, there's some parts that seems to be its own myth. That the way that some of the, and there's so many different varieties, it's, some scholars would say you can't even talk about Gnosticism as one movement. That it's not this one thing. It'd be like if we started talking with the rest of the world and saying, well, the American idea is, like, yeah, you don't get to do that because there's not one idea in America. So we're not even sure what to do with all this. We'll talk, I think, I plan on talking more about the Christian versions, but they had, like, Sethian Gnosticism seems to be very attached to a departure from Judaism, but doesn't seem to have much to do with Christianity. Valentinian Gnosticism is very much a Christian Gnostic movement. So there, it's a very kind of interesting thing, and to even know how we go is difficult to talk about it. But the church really found this to be a struggle. So Irenaeus, in 180, is writing his Against the Heresies. The vast majority of his effort in that document is against the Gnostics. This is perceived as a real threat to the church, partially because, and it's always the case, right? But it's a real threat because of how close some of the Gnosticism is to the church. If it's night and day difference, you can say, oh, that, those people are crazy. They're over there. That's not us. It's when they're, like, a lot of what they say is they're using our scriptures. What are we supposed to do with that kind of a thing? Yes to what you said, I guess. That 10-minute detour to say that. Yes, but the forms are in the realm of the ideas. Right. They're very much immaterial. So for the Gnostic, the Christian Gnostic, salvation equals escape from this human fleshly body. So the idea of your soul being transported to this spiritual realm called heaven, that kind of stuff is very much in keeping with a Gnostic idea, because the thing you want to do is get rid of the flesh.
Do you know Charles Williams?
I don't think I do. Oh, okay. I'd have to kind of read him to be able to speak to that. You do get this divide between Plato and Aristotle on that very issue. And the church is going to side with one or the other at different times. So Plato is going to say this physical world is the world of illusion. The real world is the world of the ideas. So this is if I say the word chair, you all think of chair. And this is a chair, but it's only a chair because in some ways it participates in the ideal chair. Well, they would say, if I say chair and I ask you to think of a chair, describe it to me. Four legs, but if it has four legs, it could be a stool, right? It can't. Or shouldn't be, yes. Not only does it have to have four legs, it has to have a back, right? A chair has a back. Or it's a stool. And we all would agree with that. Well, why? Because there's this one thing that this all participates in. Some of the early churches thinking about sacraments is tied to Platonic thought, in that these elements truly are the body and blood of Christ because they participate in the real body and blood of Christ. They somehow make real for us that thing that is over there. But so the Platos, they were saying that ideas, the spiritual stuff is what's real. This stuff is all illusion. We're all living in a cave. Someday we will come out of the cave and see in the light of day. Aristotle's the opposite. He says, he would say, the only reason we can talk about the fact that all of us would have this image of a chair and all of us would have four legs and all of us would have a back on our chair, the only reason you do that is because we've all experienced chairs. This is what matters. This. You only know ideal chair because you have experienced the concrete chair. And you extrapolate from your experience to make generalities. In science, Aristotle is much more important than Plato for science. We do experiments and we extrapolate from those experiences what we think we can assert as some kind of universal principle. That's all Aristotelian.
Except for
math. Yes. And there are ways in which the church has said, and I'm glad they've said, yes at times, and yes at times. So, how did we get here? It is very Platonic. Yes. The spiritual realm is what matters. Interestingly enough, one of the fundamental challenges of Gnosticism, and it's still a challenge today. Gnosticism was a threat to Christianity because it presented an alternate view of why there was evil or suffering in the world. This is one of the greatest challenges to the faith. An all-powerful, all-good God, yet we see suffering. We see evil. How do you get there? And we've struggled with this. There are all kinds of answers to this. None of them, no matter what you think, are completely satisfactory. Gnosticism has a different answer. There's evil in the world because the world's evil. There is not a good God that made this world. There's another God, a first mover, a prime mover, that is above the God, the demiurge, that made this physical world. So whatever God the Jews are worshiping that created this world is not a good and all-powerful God. Because this world is evil. You actually should be surprised that there's not more evil than there is. And so this was an interesting, it was sort of a challenge at a fundamental level to the Christian faith. Because it offered a different reason for this big, big problem of why is there suffering and evil in the world. So there was a hand. There would be they would deny, of course. But I would say that there is a very Gnostic kind of a thread to Mormonism. Bloom, I can't remember his first name, literary critic, Harvard. Someone said name? Yes. He said that he thought most of American Christianity was much closer to ancient Gnosticism than it was to ancient creedal Christianity. It's interesting how a lot of polls nowadays, even more outside the church, how does that work?
on the same channel.
Yeah.
You're on channel, yeah, 16.
All right, it should be on now.
Turn it off.
Turn it off.
Thanks. And people who haven't been formally educated in Latin, for example. So what we do see in Gnosticism seems to be connected to a more kind of philosophical upper middle class to higher end society kind of a thing. Yeah, and that's a very interesting verse, because we don't know exactly when this is starting and where we're starting to feel its increasing influence as we get into the second, third century. But is, you know, the Greeks seek knowledge? That would have been gnosis in the Greek. So, I mean, is that verse actually about kind of a proto-Gnosticism, or is it really about knowledge? It could be either way, and I think they both fit, but yeah, there are those kind of things. And if we have time, and I don't remember, let's come back to that divide of the signs and the knowledge, because if we have time, I'd like to talk about Montanus, who is another heresy, and it's going to be this issue about signs, basically, that occurs. One of the peculiar things about Gnostics back then, with their disparaging attitude towards the human body, they ridicule Christians for their pursuit of martyrdom, which I scratch my head at. If the goal is really to escape this fleshly body, there's no better way to do that than through death. But over and over and over again, we see documents where they're ridiculing Christians who think foolishly, that by declaring we are Christians at the point of their death, they will somehow receive salvation. They just saw the human body as not even worthy of being sacrificed. But to me, that's a non sequitur. That just doesn't even make, if the body's a bad thing, get rid of it as soon as you can. We have no records at all of Gnostics voluntarily pursuing martyrdom. They seem to run the other way, actually, which doesn't—it's not in line with their system of thought, in my opinion, and I think helps speak against the truthfulness of where they are. They weren't willing to die for their beliefs, basically. That's an interesting point. Yeah, that could explain it. Yes. That is very Gnostic. That in one of the Gnostic creation myths, there is a struggle, And out of the abortion of one of the female gods, the physical world is created. So this is like something that, it's life that was, it's just like unlife or anti-life, something. That we have these gods, and after each emanation of gods, each god gets further and further away from the true God, and more corrupt. And then somewhere down the line, sometimes it was 12 emanations, sometimes it was 10 emanations. 10 emanations, that's a funny thing to say. Eventually you get to this place where the created world happens by accident and by an aberration, actually. So yeah, you're right. It's a very Gnostic kind of a thing, which is why the early church is so steadfast in the goodness of God, in the fleshliness of Jesus, those kind of things. It will not give up. And so we talked earlier a couple weeks ago about how at times we're seeing strains in the Jewish-Christian relationship. Here's the charge or the attack of Gnosticism is one point at which Christianity and Judaism are not going to be allowed to be separated, because we're going to agree against the Gnostics, against Marcion, about the value of the First Testament. As much as we're feeling a strain of family tension, we're going to hold hands on this one thing, the value of the First Testament. And so it almost is like a linchpin that it won't go any further than that. It's going to kind of swing from there. So even though it's a challenge, in some ways it was a good thing, because the church could have gone another direction had it followed Marcion. It could have been very Gnostic. But no, we're gonna hold on to the goodness of creation, the goodness of the God of creation, and the fleshliness of this Jesus that we follow. So, yeah. Other statements, comments, issues that you know about Gnostics that you would want to mentioned before I turn the tables and go somewhere else here. Yeah, I think so. The whole secret knowledge that the church suppressed. So there is this whole notion that has some truth to it, but has been overplayed to an extreme degree, that the Christianity that now exists as the Christian faith is simply the one that won. That there were all these competing, and any one was viable, and any of them had some substantiality in these texts. And there were all these competing versions. And it just so happened, whether by might or by coercion or by manipulation, somehow what we call now Orthodox Christianity is only Orthodox Christianity because we won the day. And that these other things then were simply suppressed. Well, that is a way to look at it, but if you're trying to teach truth and you're teaching to the people that are under you, you do try to call out where there is error. I don't see the church as animated about heresy when it's outside the church in this early stage. They're not nearly as concerned about those pagans and their stupid Gnosticism. No, they're concerned about Gnosticism because we've got bishops who are teaching Gnostic things in the church. That's a problem. That Jesus didn't actually physically rise from the dead. That his spirit came back somehow. Well, that matters to the church. We can't allow that kind of a thing to occur. And so what we're going to see, I don't want to go too far down this road just yet, but what we're going to start to see, a couple things happen. As we're ending the second century, beginning the third, some movements are occurring. One of them is the threefold ministry of the leadership of the church. So you have bishop, priest or elder, and deacon. That gets pretty much solidified. By the end of 200, this is in place for the vast majority of the church. The other thing that's occurring is not only are we seeing bishops, but now the Bishop of Rome is starting to assert predominance over other bishops. by the end. So we have 189, the Bishop of Rome is a guy by the name of Victor. And he is starting to talk about, he essentially has a disagreement with the bishop from Carthage. And he's going to assert his authority over that. And there's just, the story's just so kind of wild and crazy and fun at the same time. And one of the reasons that the Bishop of Rome, the Roman Church, gets to be seen as having superiority is that it has the relics of Peter and Paul. Yeah, that was the right answer. Come and visit at the reliquarium. That's what it's called.
So how did that whole concept get started, that suddenly I could have the index finger and the Pope's thumb and the person on display in a room and you're all going
to pay money? So... It's very difficult to defend a position that's not yours well, okay? So let me start by saying that. So I'm sure I'm not going to do an admirable job for my Catholic brothers and sisters. And I'm certain that that's not a part of my own spiritual pilgrimage, let me say that. But part of the theology, what's behind that is, if this person lived a life full of grace, and we know, we've heard and seen or been told about testimonies of miracles being done in and through this person, why would God, if he is not going to give this body up in its grave, why does that grace on that body stop at the point of breath stopping? I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm just saying that's part of what's underneath this. That these were blessed people that did miracles. And if God isn't going to give up that body, which we believe that he's not, he's going to claim that body again in resurrection. That body is coming back. That person is going to get that body back. If that body has not been abandoned by God, does that mean that the grace is still there? And the other part of it is I have to allow in my thinking, and I love to think that I understand God, I have to allow enough room that he gets to do things that doesn't make sense to me. That I say he really shouldn't work that way, but he seems to. I have some friends, I've told you before, that are men of God who have at times behaved not like men of God, who God has continued to use in mighty ways. And I think that's not really how that ought to go. You've got to get really good people, Lord. And that I would not get to come to the club then at that point. But well, sure. There's a... Absolutely.
There is area now as the most
the Roman church supposedly had also a piece of scrap wood that was from the manger, supposedly. Now, you know, so that's like not my world that I live in that at all. And I, you know, they're just kind of part of me just says, yeah, whatever. But when we were in Findlay, there's a small town, probably smaller than Dillsburg, that was just south of Findlay, about 15 miles in Ohio. And there's a place there called the National Shrine to Our Lady. This doesn't make sense for me. This math doesn't add up. But you go there, you visit this place where apparently some miracle happened in the past. There's a kind of a long description of what actually occurred there. There is a room full of wheelchairs and crutches of people who have been healed from having been there and visited. I don't get that. You know, have a shrine to Jesus or something like that. This stuff doesn't make sense. It's not how it ought to work. I try to be careful of saying, God, you can't work that way. You can't use relics. You can't use this. You can't even use mistaken relics. Why couldn't he use, you know, my uncle's toenail as opposed to... what makes that impossible, I guess, at that point? So, Arlene... Sure.
From the island, you have the curse, and then
right, back. Yes.
Well, the point being, how do you know how these things work?
Yeah, and for me, that's where I say, because of my understanding of the Holy Spirit with me and with the collected community, I don't know that we have to chase after those things. When he has already made the promise that he is with you and will never leave you nor forsake you, this is not about getting more of God, ever. It's always about surrendering more of who we are that God can have more of us. So don't ever hear me saying that I'm kind of advocating for these things, but I get how we got there. And it is an interesting theology that why would God have given up this body if he really isn't going to give that body in the last day? He's going to give it back, so... Jason.
It strikes me that how that would work in a world where you're trying to separate yourself from Gnosticism and Platonic ideas, where you value the body so deeply. I feel like that the idea of the realm fits that kind of world really well, actually.
And it goes back to what we talked about Celsus last week is why would God want these decomposing, decaying, worm-infested bodies that the church seems to gather up? This is wrong. So we'll end with this happy note. One of the outcomes of this push from Victor, Bishop of Rome, at the end of the second century, is going in order to try to combat this Gnosticism, places where like Valentinian Gnosticism is prevalent, he's going to start, at this early stage, they're consecrating the bread for communion in Rome, and the bishop is sending it out to different places. Other bishops would consecrate and send it out. The Roman bishop is going to quit sending the consecrated bread to places where there is a Valentinian Gnostic in charge, for example. This is kind of the groundwork that's starting to get laid for eventually what we'll see as excommunication. If you are receiving grace by communion, and that's the understanding already at this point, that this is going on, and you're now being denied that officially by the church, that's a pretty strong statement from the church. It's a serious exertion of control. And we're going to see that before the close of the 100s. This is happening late 189 to early 200s.
I know there's a few minutes left of questions, but we're in the 100s and moving into the 200s.
they're all over the place. So we're going to see with Irenaeus a very clear expectation of a very soon return of Christ. So he's 180 writing, and he's really thinking that Christ is returning, so much so that some of his documents are going to get hidden by his followers that seem to come out to be proven wrong. But the other parts of the church seem to be starting to take a longer-term view of this thing. So the church is really kind of, to think that there's one view as to the timetable, for example, is to be mistaken. There are a variety of opinions. I think it's understandable that once you get about 100 years away from the death and resurrection of Jesus, there's enough reason to say, we're not quite sure that God's clock is running at the same speed as our clock. Correct. No. There within Christianity, true Christianity, Orthodox, proto-Orthodox Christianity at this point, there is we don't see any evidence of not expecting Christ's return. Yeah. The question of its immediacy is the only one that's on the table. The other one that's playing a little bit is how literal, in Revelation, is it 21, it talks about the millennial reign of Christ. How literal is that supposed to be understood? That is a question that still resounds today in biblical scholarship that is happening even at this point is how are we supposed to understand that Jesus is going to come back, take the believers away, rule on earth for 1,000 years, then come back again and wrap everything up a second? I mean, is that what's going to happen? Or is the 1,000 years a more figurative thing about the rule of God over is just about long term? The church is debating that stuff even at this point. So the immediacy issue and the literalness of the millennium are kind of the two eschatological issues that are at play. That and the nature of the bodily resurrection that we talked about last week about, with Origen and Irenaeus. So thanks. We'll keep on plugging. We're not into the 300s yet, but we will get there soon. So.